The Tom Woods Show, episode 1413.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Folks, if you enjoy the Tom Woods Show, it's time to go to the next level. And next level, Tom Woods, is libertyclassroom.com. This is where my friends and I teach all the stuff you did not get in your conventional education, history, economics, and more, the way it ought to be taught, with all the content they left out or distorted. Check it out at libertyclassroom.com. Hi, everybody. Tom Woods here. Glad to welcome Michael Malice back once again. We continue with Michael Malice Week on the Tom Woods Show as we talk about his brand new book, just released by St. Martin's, The New Right, A Journey to the Fringe of American Politics. Michael, welcome back yet again.
Thanks, Tom.
Here you are for the fourth episode of Michael Malice Week. Delighted to be promoting and talking about your book, The New Right. Today, I want to talk heroes and villains for a little while. There are some, let's start with villains, because they're much more interesting than heroes a lot of times.
You're speaking to the right person there.
That's right.
I do like my villains, yes.
And the New Right has villains in its pantheon. And in particular, you have in here interesting quotation or reference to Vox Dei and what he had to say about Bill Buckley.
Oh, yeah.
And it was something along the lines of, actually, do you want to say it?
Well, I don't have it in front of me, but yeah, something along the lines of when the alt-right comes to power, the first thing that we're going to do is dig up Bill Buckley's corpse and set it on fire, right?
Yeah, something like that. Now, I don't know if he used alt-right or not. I mean, he may have said like when the revolution comes or some kind of thing like that, but either way, there's something he doesn't like about Bill Buckley. You have often spoken to me as if Bill Buckley were the devil, and I'm not a fan of Bill Buckley either. Although when I was a little kid, back when I liked Rush Limbaugh and the Usual People, I thought Bill Buckley was like the greatest intellectual I knew. But I was a kid at the time, right?
Sure.
So I'd like to start there. What's your beef with Bill Buckley? First of all, I bet there are people listening to this who are young enough, they don't even know the name Bill Buckley. So first of all, who was he?
And that's telling.
It is telling because Rothbard was, some of them know Rothbard, even though they're youngsters, but they don't know Buckley.
They know Rand.
And Buckley died more recently than Rothbard.
Much more recently.
Yeah.
And his magazine that he founded still is creeping along.
Yep.
I actually did an interview with one of my favorite people, Kurt Schlichter, who is a good conservative, very feisty. If you guys don't follow him on Twitter, you're missing out.
I watched that interview. That was a great one.
Yeah, Kurt is like his Ben Shapiro's lawyer. Don't hold that against him. But he's on Twitter. You think I'm a troll? He's like in his 50s. He's served in the military. And people come at him and be like, you know, blah, 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 just yelling at him. And he'll just go, yeah, your mom. And it is so juvenile and dumb. And he's a very, very bright guy. And then they're like, oh, real funny. You're 50 years old and making jokes. And then he goes, yeah, your mom thought it was funny. I don't know why. I find it so amusing that someone of his stature, this big shot lawyer, is just being like a 12-year-old.
I love it.
But the interview I did with Kurt, he was saying to me, Bill Buckley is a populist.
Are you kidding me?
I couldn't believe it.
The anti-populist on every level. And in fact, on religious matters, when the subject came up about the old Latin Mass, there are a lot of ways you can argue that they should have kept the old Latin Mass. And you can say that the average person in the pew could follow along and it united all the Catholics around the world. But Buckley expressly portrayed it as, look, we snooty intellectuals want a Mass too. Why can't we have it? That was how he portrayed it. He was an elitist to his core.
Buckley is an elitist in the worst sense. This idea of noblesse oblige, holier than thou, sanctimoniousness. And he's such a pompous phony. I'll give you an example. You know, he's this kind of, you know, oh, Mr. Catholic, he talks in this certain accent as if he's a villain in a Disney movie. And I remember some interview he did, right? And he was making the claim, which I guess in some sense intellectually is logically necessary, that, and it was a book about his faith that came out, that if Jesus didn't come back, that he'd be Jewish, that Buckley would be Jewish. Because he finds the religion so appealing. And I'm sitting there, I'm like, who the heck are you kidding? Like, I assure you, there were no one like you in yeshiva. It was so ridiculous and just vile, everything about him. So as I show in this book, he's one of these types who thinks they're very professional and classy and dignified and have principles. And his biggest principle is throwing people overboard for the sake of the progressives. He couldn't wait to jettison his yacht from people he thought were beneath him. And he did so in the vilest, most snide, sneering ways. And this is a leftist trope to this day, where it's like, oh, I'm a good Harvard man. And meanwhile, you're making jokes just like Kurt, but you're, you know, framing them slightly differently. And the example I use in the book, when Rand died, Ayn Rand died in 1982, Atlas Shrugged might have brought more people around to the virtues of capitalism than any other book, maybe than Adam Smith, in terms of numbers. I don't know what else would be up there. Economics, one lesson, maybe. And Buckley writes, Ayn Rand is dead, and so is her philosophy. It was, in fact, stillborn. And it's like, she's not even buried, and you're making cracks at her, and you're using a stillbirth joke? You are a lowlife, and a Catholic to boot?
And that was not the only rotten obituary he wrote against people who, with whom he is supposed to at least have held some views in common. I mean, if he is who he says he is, he at least has something in common with Ayn Rand. He's got something in common even with Murray Rothbard, obviously.
Listen, I'm not a classy guy. When people die, I make a meme about them immediately. I get them up on Facebook. I have a laugh. I think it is fair when people say there's a tastelessness there, that you're making a joke. But I'm not trying to be classy. I know that this is gauche and tacky and inappropriate. There's no pretense to the contrary. So the fact that he is writing as soon as their body hits the ground, going after them and attacking them is so – I mean, whatever happened to the principle of thou shalt not speak ill of the dead and have some graciousness? Is there any time to appreciate someone's positive accomplishments than their obituary? You can look at their record later. And in terms of putting into context, but if someone is dead that week and you and they have a lot of friends in common, you can certainly have asterisks and be like, I didn't agree. She got this wrong here. But to take that moment to savage them, I think speaks enormously to his character and to the phoniness of his persona. And there's a great movie called Best of Enemies with him and Gore Vidal, where they had these serious debates.
Oh, yeah.
They were covering, what was it, the 60, was it 64 or 68? I think 68 convention.
Yeah, because I don't think he had his show yet in 64.
Yeah, and the two of them, I mean, talk about ego and hubris. The two of them really had this messianic quality, and the venom and the pompousness from both of them just permeates through every pore and just hits you in the face through the television.
But Vidal really, really got under Buckley's skin. And as you say, his persona was one of cool philosophizing, and he's going to be relaxing on his yacht and this and that. But when he was with Gore Vidal, I mean, he stood up, and because Vidal kept calling him a crypto-fascist.
Yeah.
And Buckley got up and said, stop calling me and he used language I don't want to use on this show.
Wait, can I use it?
If it's the word I'm thinking of, we're going to have to bleep it out.
Fine. I don't think you should bleep it out. He just says, if you say that one more time, and he called him a queer and says, I'll punch you in the face and you'll stay plastered.
Oh, okay. So that doesn't include the word. I'll tell you the word later. Suffice to say is the word the Knights of Neat cannot hear. I can't say what the word is at the moment.
Yeah. So, and Buckley later in life felt humiliated because he thought the footage was lost. And I'll defend Buckley on that regard, because if you're heated and you blurt something out out of anger, that's much more excusable than an obituary, which is calm and you reasoned and you thought about it.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, no, I actually don't hold the other thing against him. I just thought it was interesting to see him rattled because it happens so infrequently. All right, so he's a villain, but in a way, he's more of an irrelevancy than a villain. Because
No. He's emblematic.
He's emblematic, but in the sense of nobody talks about him today. That's what I mean.
But his baleful influence permeates conservatism, Inc. And the desperation. I was on Wilkow's show today, and he was singing the praises of Mitt Romney.
This is Andrew Wilkow, who's on Sirius XM.
And I said to him, I go, Romney would have won if he fought Obama as hard as he's fighting Trump.
Well, I don't know where I'd begin with that.
What, do you disagree?
I do disagree. And secondly, to act as if that would have mattered in the world, like one wing of the establishment beats the other, is exactly why I don't care about this stuff.
Hold on. You're telling me that if Romney, first of all, do you disagree that Romney fights Trump harder than he fought Obama?
I don't know. I mean, everything, I don't know. Maybe. It's possible.
Okay. Well, I just think that what the base responds to is owning the libs and sticking to them in aggression. And I think that would have made a somewhat of a difference. Maybe he wouldn't have won. I'll give you that caveat. But it certainly, I think, would have helped his campaign.
Yeah, it's just that I think even he realized that he doesn't have it in him to do that stuff. It doesn't come out sounding plausible when he talks that way.
Nothing he does sounds plausible. Yes, I mean, the guy has no soul.
And that's why, again, I don't think if we were talking about villains, I think Mitt Romney is such a non-entity.
He's not in the book. He's not a villain.
Yeah.
No.
So he doesn't. So give me an example of somebody else that, again, I know the idea is that a lot of the people you're chronicling here, they're all independent people. There's no organization uniting them. They may have different opinions, but surely they've got a few people they all agree are terrible baleful influences. And I'd like to know a couple of examples and why. Why are these people bad?
Well, I will also say pretty much the people I write about in one context or another, they're all villains. The people who are the protagonists of the book are all villains in terms of the corporate press, in terms of the culture. They are all vilified and regarded as the enemy.
That is true.
So, and I, of course, I'm sitting here as I talk to you looking. I got a contribution from PayPal from a dear reader, and they said to me, here's $300. Buy yourself a nice dinner. Or spend it on something stupid. And I'm like, all right, a contract is a contract. You've given me money for a purpose. It would be immoral to spend it on things that are not stupid. So what I'm looking at is I'm looking right now at a box with a bottle of Dallas brand aftershave and cologne from the 80s. Because Dallas, J.R. Ewing, was the great villain of all time. Villains, I think, are always much more interesting than the heroes when they're done correctly. But in terms of the villains of this book, I don't even know that I have that many. I'm much more focused on who the culture regards as villains. I mean, it would be institutions like the media, the universities, the Buckley wing of conservatism. And certainly I don't agree with Jared Taylor and Chris Cantwell, but I'm not there to demonize them. I let them speak for themselves because there's plenty of demonization of everyone in this book to be had. If you want anyone in this book to be described as a complete, Nazi, go ahead. There's no shortage, including Rand and including Rothbard. Oh, no, there's two more villains. This is really funny. Tom, tell me did you not laugh at Rand going after Stigler and Friedman as Stalinists?
Oh, yeah, because they were taking like a utilitarian position on rent control.
Yeah. So she, Ayn Rand, who I love her so much. I love her ironically and unironically. She writes a letter to Leonard Reed, who is the head of FEE, Foundation for Economic Education, in all caps. So she's sitting there holding on the shift key. I don't know, maybe she had an assistant type it, or it's just she wrote it by hand. In all caps, just yelling that this is the worst thing. That was her words, like the worst thing that any avowedly conservative publication ever published, that you have these two reds arguing that, we could have rent control or not, and to just discuss it like you're divvying up a pot like any other. And like, this is basically Stalinism. You've given up the principle of private property. And to be fair, she has a point.
I mean, that is a point, but I think the language is probably exaggerated. I think there have been worse offenses than that. And incidentally, she later on became a big cheerleader for Nixon, and one could argue that maybe that was not the best move somebody could have made. And I know she would say, but under the circumstances, it's what we had to do. But all right, it's true what you say about the villains, and that, of course, your book is primarily focused on people who are perceived as villains, and that the villains in the book are generally institutional, like the media and so on. What's the difference between the way the Republican Party might be found to criticize the media? Now, excluding Trump. I mean, Trump is pretty out there on the media.
Yeah.
But generally, there have been complaints about the, quote, liberal media for as long as I've been politically aware.
Right.
How is what's going on among the people you're chronicling different from that?
I think one big difference between traditional conservatives, and when I use the word conservatives, and I'm sure you'll agree, I love the no true Scotsman fallacy, right? oh, they're not really conservatives because they disagree with me on one issue. If someone calls themselves a conservative, I'm going to regard them as a conservative, okay? You can have your qualification and build a fence around yourself all you want. The one big difference is essential to conservative thought is the idea that if an institution exists and has existed for a long period of time, it is redeemable. It can be fixed. And this is something that's often said explicitly, but almost always more regarded as an implicit issue. Sean Davis from The Federalist, me and him got into an argument, a friendly discussion, I don't want to say argument, about the nature of the press. And his whole point is like, these are profoundly stupid people. And my point is, stupid people are not all going to make the same mistake in the same way over an extended period of time. If you ask a stupid person, you know, to name all the presidents, they're not all going to make the same mistake. Some of them are going to name Ben Franklin, you know, some of them are going to name Alexander Hamilton, and some are going to be completely blank. If they're not all going to have the same wrong answers, it's pretty hard to have the same wrong answer because you're not dealing with reality. It's a lot easier to have the same right answer because there is one right answer. So that, I think, is one big distinction. Can these institutions be fixed, or are they so inherently corrupt that they need to be destroyed and at the very least regarded as the enemy?
And I think the other side of that is the presumption that, as you've said, back in the mists of time, they were much better than they are now. And if only we could return to that. And so the same analysis appears when they talk about the universities.
Yeah.
If only we could go back to when the universities were great.
And I want to ask them, when did this bad thing happen? Because I'm not saying there are many, many very bright conservatives. And the question is, the 1930s were the red decade. America was under the Great Depression. Marxism, full-blown communist Marxism, not the theory that we should be like Soviet Russia, was in full sway. When Ayn Rand was trying to publish her first novel, We the Living, she was told explicitly, you just don't understand the Soviet experiment, right? She had just fled and lived it, but you don't get it. We get it. We're in New York. We've read the books. We read Walter Duranty, the New York Times. So when did it become like really bad? When was it really good? The 1910s? When Woodrow Wilson is president? What are you talking about? So at a certain point, if it's been this way for 100 years, if you're going to have a golden age before electricity, sure. But I don't think that ports very well to contemporary times at all.
Now, on the other side—
Hold on. I'm sorry to interrupt you, because the same exact thing goes with the universities. As I talked about in the book, Illiberal Reformers is one of the must-read books. I quote from it a lot, very liberally, I was going to say. And the whole point is, since the 1890s, the university system, borrowing ideas from Germany, was there to create a self-aware, self-conscious elite to govern America, both through literal government, but also through various institutions. They were explicitly there, leaders of tomorrow. The expression still holds true today. These are people who they go to college, they are taught how to rule, they leave, and they think it is their job. They've got their diploma to tell everyone else how to live their lives, and that is their place in the world. This is not a recent development at all.
And we have example after example of it in our own government. I mean, Woodrow Wilson, I think, felt pretty darn confident in his righteous mission that he had as he presided over the executive branch.
It's no coincidence that Wilson was a college president, president of Princeton specifically. And Wilson said explicitly that he was sent by God to save the world. That is messianic. And I'm not a Christian. You are, Tom. To me, and please correct me if I'm wrong, if you are someone who is a human being, perceives yourself as messianic and you're not the Messiah, that to me sounds downright satanic.
Oh, I agree completely. I agree. I mean, I've done on this show just recently, we did an episode on the Battle Hymn of the Republic. And here they take biblical language and they're applying it to the U.S. government as a righteous force in the world. And that's replicated throughout into World War I. The left-wing social gospel clergy portrayed the Germans basically as Satan and the American soldier as Christ. It's just ridiculous. It's gone through. So the scholar I interviewed said, you know, somebody needs to do a study of how, not how the Bible has influenced America, but how America has influenced the Bible, the way we interpret parts of it. I mean, very, very interesting. I want to ask you about I know that you have a certain fondness for Ronald Reagan, and I have a suspicion as to why that is.
Well, the Cold War.
Yeah, well, then I'm right.
But, and also his sense of humor and his optimism.
Right. Yeah, those are all good things. But I have the feeling that people who are on what you call the new right, it's not that they would despise Reagan, but they would feel like there's just conservatism, Inc. You know, when it's the year 2150, they're still going to be having conferences about Ronald Reagan. You know, when history has totally passed them by. And I think likewise, they look at Reagan as being too, you know, he still uses universalistic language in the city on a hill
here's
and all
the
that.
Here's the issue with Reagan. Here's the issue with them and Reagan. Candace Owens has this idea that if you go to people who are African-American, whether they be, you know, on welfare or whether they're doctors, and tell them you're living on a Democratic plantation, that they're going to look at her and be like, oh, you know, golly, you're right. I'm going to start voting Republican. I mean, to me, that is a demented approach to persuasion, because someone who's free to move and free to go to a new house, even if you're in housing projects, to call them a slave is really stretching it, and it's not a very good method of persuasion. And the same thing, to go up to young people or even older people and be like, Ronald Reagan, and they'll be like, what? It's so dated and such a boomer approach to, you know, well, Reagan won two landslides. It's like, yeah, since then we've had pocket calculators and Walkman. Like, what are you talking about? And also, if the new right is very focused on actually winning, if you're going to point to, well, the last time we had these big wins was the 80s, I don't want to be in your team. That's like what, the Cubs? Isn't that the Cubs where like they didn't win for like 100 years?
Yeah, yeah. I think also it's that they get irritated with conservatives, so-called, in government and think tanks, who sound like they're still talking like it's 1982 or something.
Yeah.
And so they're using Reaganite talking points that are really not that interesting to the new right, which is focused on other issues.
We need to be using Randian and Rothbardian talking points from the 50s and 70s.
Right.
Don't these people know what era has come back?
That's exactly right. Is there anybody?
Wait. The law.
Frederick Bastiat.
Yeah, we need to talk about Bastiat. You know,
we did his talking points. At least it would be something.
And Jefferson.
Oh, that reminds me. I'm going to write about Jefferson in my email today. You'll love it. It'll be your favorite Tom Woods email of all time. Just writing myself a note
about
it.
I'm not saying much.
Yeah. Yeah, I know. That's pretty faint praise.
Tallest dwarf, yeah.
Yeah. Is there anybody that this disparate group of people would say, I mean, they're not the idolizing type, but is there anybody they'd say, yeah, that's a guy I can respect? A handful of them?
I think there is. I would say people like Buchanan, they have respect him because he became a pariah. And I think there is this element of hipsterism, and they wouldn't use that term, but in the sense of if they're going to admire someone, it's going to be someone who's not mainstream, right? Someone who's still kind of underground. So there's names like Julius Evola, you know, who's this kind of quasi-fascist type. The one name I would say that would be the intellectual of this scene, and actually, it's just very interesting because Justin Raimondo, who basically also is a historian of much of this, the predecessor to this movement, absolutely despises this person. It's the name that me and Mencius Moldbug both, you know, revere, and that's James Burnham. And James Burnham is this kind of, you know, now forgotten figure. He was one of the original National Youth people. He came out of communism. He was actually friends with Trotsky. But his book, The Machiavellians, you know, as we discussed, is kind of this idea of what democracy actually looks like behind the curtain. And he has a few, and there's also, it's either called Death of the West or Suicide of the West.
Suicide of the West, I have it.
Well, yeah. Pat Buchanan has one, and he's got the other one. One is
Right.
One, I think they have the same name. No, Pat's Death of the West. This one's
Pat's Death of the West, and then recently Jonah Goldberg came out with his own Suicide of the West.
Oh Jesus, yeah. So anyway, of the three, I can assure everyone, even though Burnham is the oldest, it is the most insightful and most profound. And I'm sure Joan is the third.
Yeah, as am I. I wish there were some way to bring Burnham's book back into ready, availability.
I think it's available. Not the Machiavellians, but I think Suicide of the West is.
Yeah, I have Suicide of the West already. The Machiavellians.
I have a signed copy, Tom. Mm-hmm.
I like you much, much better now.
Okay.
Much better.
That's
good thing you said that.
Let me ask you a question. Is that cool?
Oh, okay.
So reading this book, as you did, who did you have the most, like the least as a consequence? Like who do you think came off the worst?
Oh, okay. You mean just the portrayal just made them seem, ooh, I'm not sure I want to have dinner with that guy. Is that what you mean?
Well, I don't know. Or maybe just like who you were like, okay, this person is not deserve their stature or this institution.
I mean, I'm going to make enemies here. I mean, I feel like, well, first of all, the people you chose were carefully chosen. Like these are not, they might be for some people in America, complete no names they've never heard of.
Right.
But in politically aware circles, everybody knows every single one of these people.
Yeah.
So in that respect, they all deserve to be in there. I guess I just remember being so completely, maybe this is just my goody two shoesiness coming through, but so completely shocked.
The protagonist.
The protagonist.
The narrator.
Yeah, the narrator was the worst. But I was so shocked and scandalized by the stuff that Jim Goad did and said.
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh, you mean when he was doing Answer Me?
Right. What the heck?
Okay.
Because I know him only for articles I've seen of his in the past couple of years. That's it.
Okay. So for readers who don't know, I call Jim Goad the godfather of the new right. And he had this zine called Answer Me, and it was extremely provocative. He just recently reprinted the four-issue compilation. The first compilation only had the first three. That was like released, like let's say 20 years ago, because number four is the rape issue. Hitler's on the cover of one of them.
What is this? What does this have to do with me?
Well, you're talking about Jim Goad.
No, but it raises the question. Well, no, I'll tell you what question it raises after you're done.
Well, and famously, there's a photograph of him with the Hitler mustache, and he's got an iron cross, or he's a swastika, and there's an iron cross on the wall, and him and his wife are holding a gun. Now, his wife was Jewish, and the photographer's Israeli, right? So in contemporary terms, you kind of roll your eyes because it's just transparently provocative. But at the time, when you didn't have the internet and such imagery at your fingertips, I mean, people lost their minds. People still lose their minds, you know, understandably.
Yeah, and I mean, I have to say, it's not something I'd do.
Again?
that was a mistake, wasn't it? But see, there's something about when, you know, trying to situate the alt-right into this more general movement of people who share this revulsion at a genuine revulsion at progressivism. And that doesn't include a lot of conservatives who right. are in their heart of hearts, they still have some progressivism in there.
And also, I think they have a bunker or Stockholm syndrome. Like they, since they've been raised in a progressive dominated milieu, to use an obnoxious term, they don't see, and again, I just realized as I'm speaking right now, since conservatives basically take what's given and think it can be tweaked, but can't be, you know, totally tore down and destroyed, I think on a fundamental level, they think, well, or they don't realize, but the assumption is since this culture is so thoroughly progressive, it's never not going to be thoroughly progressive. You only have so much you can bend it.
Well, I can see that way of thinking. I don't think that's unreasonable.
I don't even know if that's their literal thought process so much as their like operating assumption that they're not even aware of. I'm realizing as I speak to you, one of the distinctions between the new right and conservatives is if conservatives take that which is given and think it can't ever be, you know, totally torn down, it can only be tweaked, of course they're going to assume that since they were raised in a culture that's so thoroughly governed by progressivism, that it will always be thoroughly progressive and you only have so much leeway to change the situation. And that's not the new right perspective.
Yeah, yeah. Although the way you put it, I can almost sympathize with that. I could see that as just being a condition of just demoralized frustration. But I'm not even sure that's quite what it is with the conservatives.
I don't even know that's demoralized. Like, if I tell you, Tom, hey, what if we lived in a world where people were barefoot all the time? You and I would have to sit through and think what that actually meant. We would never even question it, right? So I think for them, since they take what is given, and I don't think this is a slight. I think it's fair to assume that what is currently in our culture, all things being equal, will probably tend to perpetuate. That if you're like, you know, let's, you know, have this revolutionary idea, it's going to take some time for them to think this through.
Let me, before I forget, let me say what it was that I wanted to say earlier. The thing is, with this book, you're basically dealing with people who you say early on, in their positive program, they may not necessarily agree with each other or have as much in common as you would think. It's in their opponents that they have something. They all can't stand the using the Mencius Moldbug term, the cathedral, and
right.
left liberal hegemony, let's say. They're all against that. But in terms of what they're for, there are differences. But the way you organize the book, as you say, as the chapters go on, each succeeding chapter deals with somebody who is, let's say, slightly farther out from the, let's say, the center of respectability.
Correct.
Until you get out to the, you know, the farthest chapters. And when you get out to the very end, you even deal with somebody who says, yeah, I'll be honest with you. At this point, I do consider myself a Nazi sympathizer. So the thing is that when you organize, I'm not blaming you for this. I'm just saying that the impression that can be left is, well, if this is how the progression goes, as they get more and more and more extreme, then it seems like there's a natural progression. If you're just being honest with yourself, you'll eventually wind up a Nazi sympathizer. And I have nothing in common with somebody like that whatsoever. I have nothing in common.
You have something in common. Your view of progressivism.
Maybe.
Yes.
But a Nazi sympathizer wants to use the state for purpose of planning out the kind of society he wants.
Sure. So one of my quotes, and all you people out there who use this quote, you better give me credit, because for this purpose, we're going to believe in IP. And if not, they're going to have some karma and all your Bitcoin is going to be valued at zero. You take one red pill and not the whole bottle. And that's one of the reasons I did write this book, as I say up front in the book. Once you take a red pill, which is from the documentary The Matrix, which teaches that which we are told as their narrative is actually a carefully constructed lie. Once you realize this, unless you put the brakes on somewhere and you just keep going and going and going, you do end up in full-blown Holocaust denial or 9/11 never happened or any of these various mechanisms. So it's very important to speak to people who are going down the rabbit hole and be able to put the brakes on it.
All right, fair enough. And I think that is the best way to answer what I said. All right, we're going to wrap it up for today. We got one more episode with you tomorrow that, I mean, if it doesn't convince people to buy the book, then we just have to go out and use violence.
Your poor listeners, yeah. I'm so sorry that you have to hear my voice for a week. I apologize enormously.
It is my fault entirely. This was my idea. Okay, this was not, I do know some people who've been on the show who actually would be forward enough to come up to me and say, hey, can I be on your show for the entire week? But Michael would not dream of behaving that way. That's precisely why I featured.
It's only me and whoever that number two loser is.
This guy didn't even make the list. I'll tell you when we're off the air who it is. But anyway, the book is The New Right, A Journey to the Fringe of American Politics, linked at tomwoods.com/1413. Remember, Michael himself narrated the audiobook version, so you got to get that.
And I did all the voices.
And he did all the voices. If you haven't joined Audible yet, you can get that for free, and Michael still gets his royalty. Get that for free at tomwoodsaudio.com. See you tomorrow.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.